people want to aim for this evening is figuring out how to be free of suffering, how to be free of these three defilements that they're called, these three different ways of suffering, and also how to be free from inflicting that suffering onto other people as well. That's the aim of the talk this evening, to try and open this up a little bit and figure out what are they, how do we know when they're happening, and then what do we do about them? How can we work with these things rather than just be reacting all the time in ways which aren't very useful for us or for other people? And this topic really is very much at the heart of Buddhism and Buddhist practice, of Dharma practice. It's absolutely central, and I'm going to prove to you that it's central, because I've got a diagram here that some of you will be familiar with and some not, obviously. And it's a visual representation of a thing called the Wheel of Dependent Origination. Now, we are not going to get through that whole thing this evening. I don't intend to. I'm going to take aspects of it and talk about them. If you want to know more about it, you'll be able to Google it or use your search engine of choice and find out more about it. So maybe if you'd like to hang that out, that would be great. And once you've got a copy of that, we'll be able to go and start talking about that. What they were saying, those who can do, those who can't teach. Okay. Okay, this is a fairly small document. Does anybody have a copy or is able to see a copy? Share one maybe? I made 20, that should be enough, I think. And listen, I just want to say as we go along, if you want to ask questions or add anything, you're very welcome to do that. So, you know, let's make it a bit interactive. Faith, do you have a copy up there as well? Or you can see one? Or you're familiar with it anyway now? Okay. So, I said to you just before, I'm going to prove to you that the three poisons are at the heart of Buddhist practice. If you look at the centre of this wheel, you'll see there are three animals in the centre of the wheel. A pig, a snake, and what looks like a peacock, but is actually a rooster. And these represent greed, hatred and delusion, and I'll come back to those in a tick. But just very broadly, you've got... this wheel represents our human life and how we get reborn moment to moment or from life to life. And there are various links, there are usually 12 links in this particular chain or this particular wheel. And the idea of a wheel is the wheel of samsara. It just keeps turning over and over and over and over and over. And as I said earlier, I can't possibly talk about all the links this evening. I don't intend to either. But this very funky character with the fangs and his head over the top and the tiger's tail, this is Yama. Yama's the lord of death. And what this represents visually is that this wheel of samsara is in the grip of death. This is the case for all conditioned existence, that it's subject to decay, to death. And you'll notice on the top right-hand side there that the Buddha is actually outside of this wheel, that there is an escape from this wheel. So this is, you know, very broadly what this wheel comes to represent. Now, just outside that inner circle, you've got black and white, a slightly larger circle, and these are various sorts of karma, people going down or going up according to their karma, black or white. Then in the large part of the wheel, you've got the various realms, six realms here. And the probably, in a way, I'm going to say the most important bit, but it's certainly a very important part of this wheel, are the 12 links themselves, which is the outer edge of this wheel. We're going to look at some of those things as well in relation to these three poisons. So, the three poisons that are represented here are greed, hatred, and delusion. Or aversion, which would be hatred. Greed's probably, I don't think, a very good translation. It's probably craving, or a stronger version of desire, I think, is the word we're searching for here, and I'll explain that a bit later. And delusion is ignorance as well, not knowing what's going on, not having a chance to, you know, check out diagrams like this and see how our lives work. So, you know, the start of the Buddhist path is right view, and we need to investigate to understand what that is. Well, this is part of the very first part of Buddhist practice, is understanding what's going on. So it's said that these various parts of the wheel all spin on that central hub, on greed, hatred and delusion. So they really are at the very heart of this process that we're talking about, these three poisons. So greed, anybody want to take a guess as to which one's greed? People who don't know, or craving? What do you reckon? Somebody says pig. What do you think? You've got a 33.3% recurring chance of being correct on this one. It's actually the rooster, believe it or not. And if anybody's had chickens, hello. Has anybody ever had chickens? Kept chickens? Yeah, you'll see the way they run around and actually eat everything. You know, don't leave anything standing still in the chicken coop because they'll eat everything. It's really true. So which one do you think would be aversion or hatred? The snake. The snake. That sort of makes sense, doesn't it? So what does that leave us with? Sorry? The delusional pig. In English, we sometimes talk about people being pig ignorant. So that's a way of remembering it. But it's a bit unfair on the poor old pig because they're quite a smart animal, aren't they? So it's a little unfair, but it's the traditional representation. So these are visual representations of these qualities, in fact, that all of us are said to have. Now, it's not all of who we are, but it's what keeps us in this suffering cycle. You know, very fundamental movements of our mind, perhaps, or our emotions, or our heart, that keep us suffering. So, greed or craving is this sort of self-centered desire to have more. And it's not just material objects, it might be to have more information, desire for pleasure, desire for possessions. We want to be seen better amongst our comrades. That would be a form of craving as well. Yeah.
What about desire to make
a life? It's a really good question actually, and it comes up quite a lot as you can imagine. There's different, desire has different names in the Pali text, and the sort of desire you're talking about is called chanda. And it's different to the desire we're talking about here. It's a desire that leads away from suffering. So these are the desires that lead towards suffering, towards the wheel just keeping on spinning, perhaps faster and faster. So desire for enlightenment is said to be a very smart thing to have. It's the desire to be released from this sort of suffering, which is pretty smart really when you think about it. Another way of thinking about desire is intention. And we have an intention to wake up, which is the literal translation of enlightenment, awakening. So that intention is a positive desire. The desire to be friendly, like we just practiced before, would be a really positive desire as well for all sorts of reasons. So there are definitely, you know, desires that are very useful for us to cultivate. Yeah. So then we have the snake, which is aversion, and it's really that movement of the mind at its most fundamental that rejects or pushes away, that separates oneself from others and then raises oneself up very often above others in our own mind. And at its most extreme would come out as hatred. But irritation, condemning other people, probably forms of gossip I would think would fit in there. You know, feeling enmity, anger, and being violent would be probably one of the ultimate expressions of that, I think, of aversion. And delusion means not really understanding what's going on. So it means we're sort of insensitive to reading more subtle signals in ourselves and from others about what leads to suffering and what leads away from suffering. And it's often said that we mistake what is suffering for what is pleasurable because we work at a fairly gross sort of level. And this is something more that meditation reveals, I think, as you go along and sensitizes the mind and the feelings, and we wake up more to those more subtle cues that tell us what's really going on. Okay, so it's greed, hatred and delusion. And from those three basic movements of mind, all the other afflictive emotions, the difficult emotions, the difficult actions, the bad actions in religion, and we could probably have a little workshop just listing on the board all the various ways that these things express themselves. It's really worthwhile in your own time to have a think to yourself, what does this mean for me? When I'm caught with one of these three poisons, how does it express for me? And it might be somewhat different for other people around you as well. Because there's no point coming to the talk tonight, including for me, and just looking at this intellectually. Really, so what? You can read a book, you know, do the exam and forget it later. So it's got to actually make a difference in your own life. It's got to make sense to you as well. And it means it has to be taken on board for yourself as well. We're pretty good at looking at all the bad things about other people. Oh, you know, the three defilements in her, they look like this. You know, what a dreadful person. And we really need to hold a mirror up sometimes. And just to say here that some people really struggle with this. They really get caught with what a bad person they are. Now, particularly in, I guess, Western culture, there's a lot of people beating themselves up for not being good enough. And that's also useful. It's just another form of ego, really, in a way. You know, I'm the worst person in the world. Well, no, you're probably not the worst person in the world. Sorry. Hello. And often when people beat themselves up, they don't go the next step, which is to say, well, how do I stop doing this? How do I improve? So it's like a reflex action that says, oh, I'm dreadful, and they sort of psychologically beat themselves. But nothing really happens after that. So it's sort of fundamentally useless beating yourself up. And beating yourself up often gets a fantastic response from other people, doesn't it? Oh no, you're not the worst person in the world, you're really a lovely person, you know, and so we actually get something back from that, but it doesn't make us change, we just get really good at beating ourselves up. Because the brain doesn't care what we practice. We practice, in a sense, these things which lead to suffering. What do we get good at? We get good at suffering. If we practice skillful things, we get good at those. The brain just does what it's told to do, in a repeated sort of way, really. So in a way, if we just do things that are positive, we're going to develop positive mind states. This is what this organism does. That's the good news, really, isn't it? So we don't have to be special people. This is just what everybody's brain does. Fortunate for us. But unfortunately, if we keep doing unskillful things, we get really good at those too. And it becomes our default position, doesn't it? It's just what comes out under pressure. And that's when we really see where the three poisons are. When we're under pressure, we start seeing, you know, that greed around who we are and how people see us, or our aversion towards others, who we think aren't treating us properly, and so forth and so on. And often we're just not seeing very clearly. We are in a fog of emotion usually at that stage, a fog of reaction. But this delusion is really like a fogginess of the mind, in a sense. That's what we're really pointing out here. So, to remove these delusions, or to understand and then remove them, it's a path of practice, really, isn't it? It takes work. We can't come to one talk and now I understand intellectually and that's enough, because it's not enough. Because usually we've practiced some of the three poisons to some extent, pretty extensively, and they're pretty well ingrained in it. So it takes equal amounts of practice to help them filter out again. The three poisons and all these other sorts of addictive emotions and actions all spring from ignorance. Delusion, not understanding what's going on. If we start to clear up what's going on, at least we have a chance of doing something. But if we're not even at that point of understanding, then we can't do anything. We remain pig ignorant, as the diagram shows us. And the wheel of samsara keeps spinning very merrily. We keep being reborn moment to moment as an ignorant person. We get good at being ignorant. So it's not enough to build up a vast store of knowledge about the Dharma. It's really not enough. Because it doesn't necessarily shift anything at a much more fundamental level. It's very useful. We need to have information, but then we need to practice in a different sort of way. We need to live in a different sort of way. So the Buddha's path is really a path of practice. It's a path of living. It's not just a path of study and reflection. And it's not just a path of prayer either. It's a path of practice. So I want to look at some of these of the outer link here now. So this sort of largest inner circle here, and I want to look at now where are we on here? if you go to down to the tiger's tail, and you'll see a little sort of oval there, and it's a couple embracing. I don't know if you can make that out. Can people see that? And this is the Pali word is tassa, which means contact. So people embracing are contacting very strongly. So there's the, it's more than just touch. It's a sense of real contact, solid contact. And it's, what this means is, I'm going to talk a bit more about this, but contact with any sort of phenomena internally or externally. So when an emotion begins and we have consciousness of it, that's contact. When we have a sensation of the body, that very first sensation, that's contact. A sound hits the eardrum, and there's knowing of it, that's contact. So this is what the word tassa means here, and it's said to be part of our everyday experience. And if you think about it, we must have this. We don't contact with anything, we can't know anything. You know, if we haven't got sight, we can't contact with visual objects, we can't know them, because we don't have sight. So we need the sense organs as well here, as well as consciousness, as well as this thing that's happening. So for a sound, to know a sound, we need the sound itself, we need the eardrum, and we need the ability to know that, for consciousness to arrive in relation to that particular thing. So similarly with all of the body and the mind as well, so the internal contact as well. So if an intention arises to do something, we can know that's arisen. There's contact internally as well. So in Buddhism, the mind, as you probably know, is the sixth sense. We have six senses. So the next one that we can see here, you'll see a man with an arrow in his eye. Can people see that? Just a little bit further around the circle there, right next to contact. That's vedana or sensation. So clearly, if you've got an arrow in your eye, there's a strong sensation. It's a feeling, and the feeling is usually just a primary feeling of pleasant or unpleasant. So this one, he's gone beyond unpleasant to something stronger. But at the very first point, it's something you do like or you don't like. This is the sense of feeling or vedana here. This is. The reason I'm talking about this sort of sequence is it's incredibly important in meditation practice as well. Really important. This is really, I think, meditation practice hinges on these four or five parts of this wheel of dependent origination. So really useful. And it's a way of thinking about the three poisons and how they manifest with us as well. Then we've got the next one, which is the guy smoking opium. And this one is craving. You know, what a surprise. Tanha, craving. It literally means thirst, actually. I'm going to come back to the literal meaning of tanha, thirst. Interesting. So clearly, you know, craving for opium, but craving for more is really what it means here, at any level. And again, it can be craving for external things like opium, or it can be craving for internal things like brilliant thoughts, or an emotional state of some sort. You know, don't we love having a brilliant thought? And how quick we are to say, that's my thought, I had it. You know, look at me. You know, we get lots of good feedback for having brilliant thoughts. So this is craving. But there's even more than craving or thirst. And the next one is a monkey. You can see the monkey there in the tree plucking fruit, hanging onto the fruit. This is upadana, and it represents clinging or grasping. I quite like clinging as a word here, but really holding on tightly to something. So in a sense, we can have craving for something. And then if we get it, we can really, really, really invest a lot of ourselves, a lot of our time in really desperately trying to hang on to that. I'm going to come back to this one because I think this is really important. I'm going to talk quite a lot about that tonight, actually. And the next one is you probably can't see, Bhava, becoming. It's a pregnant woman. So this has the sense that because we've had contact, there's been a feeling, pleasant or unpleasant, it's developed into craving, and incidentally craving is the craving to get rid of something too, to not have it, to push it away. We've got into clinging, desperately trying to hold on to it, or to avoid it, clinging to being something other than the thing we don't want. We become. So I said before, what we practice we get good at. We become what we practice. We become what we do. We become what we think. We become what we feel. This is another meaning of karma. karma literally means action or intentional action. So what we practice, we get good at. And I guess in a more modern sense, we can think about this psychologically, that as we think, so we become. We know that to be true. We've been trained into doing certain things habitually. So this is becoming. Now, more typically, this gives rise to birth, and this is seen to happen over a number of lifetimes. And you may or may not believe that, but it doesn't really matter if you have that more traditional belief, or whether you think you're more modern and you just believe it happens in this life. It's a process that we can see that is ongoing. The wheel is turning even now as we speak. But I just want to say to you, you shouldn't believe anything I say. You really need to figure this out for yourself, don't you? You know, this is just me talking. What I know of the Dharma, it would be much better to put your own spin on this particular topic for yourself. So there's a lot of attachment in this becoming and pregnancy. We give birth to the new self all the time. And this is both good and bad news for us. You know, the good news is that we can change. We're constantly changing. In fact, we can't not change. But we can also change for the worse too. Okay. So, just to summarise that process then, the way this happens is that we have contact with something. Now, let's say it's a pleasant, let's say it's a sound. And it's just fairly neutral at that stage, isn't it? It's a sound, we hear something, it impinges for the first time. We might not quite know what it is. Very, very quickly, we tend to get a pleasant or unpleasant feeling. Let me demonstrate this for you. Everybody close your eyes. You have to trust me on this one. Close your eyes. I'm going to ring the bell, so you might be shocked. Now just really pay attention to what happens to you when you close your eyes and listen. What happened for you? And what was your sufficient response? And meditation is over. Half my eyes open. Okay, but sure. So there's a response. You felt it here. A lot of people feel a bell through here. Actually, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And often that produces a sort of feeling tone as well. Other people, just very simply. Be brave. Yeah.
Felt the thing ring.
You felt
the bell thing.
And how did you feel that? Where did you feel it?
Oh, it's just
like
laying my head.
Okay, so there was contact, and you noticed that contact of the sound, of the sort of, there was a feeling that was produced. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
A sort of vibration, yeah.
Like
many people talk about it as being a wave, and actually it is a wave, isn't it, really? And pleasant or unpleasant? Pleasant. Okay. Now, very quickly we go on from that. Thank you, everybody. We go on from that to say, well, this bell has a pleasant sound. We characterise it in a certain sort of way, and we get stuck with these ideas. Bells always sound pleasant. Now, I won't do this to you, but what I have done in meditation is do that. Everybody jumps and blames me and thinks how good the teacher is and all that sort of thing. But it's the same bell. You see how quickly we get in? We go through contact. We go through the feeling, which is usually pleasant or unpleasant, at a very, you know, brief moment, and then it develops into something more pleasurable or far less pleasurable, and we have a reaction. We usually have a whole set of thoughts about that. We want more of it. Oh, gee, that's lovely. Some of you might have had that feeling. That feels lovely. It just reminds me of being home, or a temple bell, or end of meditation. I quite like that. you know, we quite like that. From there, it's very easy to want more of it. I'm going to keep coming because I really like the sound of that bell. There's something special about that bell, you know. Or some people have actually said they don't like the sound of the bell. It reminds them they're going to church or temple and they really don't like that and they get quite aversive towards it and sort of want to push it away. You know, I'm not going to come to the meditation anymore. It's dreadful Dharma because they ring that dreadful bell. And we get stories about the world, which actually we don't recognise as stories. We just take them to be real, don't we? This is the way the world is. No. This is the way we think the world is, based on particular experiences. There's no room for rediscovery there, really, or change. So we need to cycle back to the beginning of the process and understand what's going on. Contact, feeling, and judgment, in a way. Craving is a sort of a judgment. And a very interesting way of working with this is to also notice that is sometimes people feel like they're leaning into the nice thing, or they're pulling it in, they want more of it. You know, if there's a smell and it's nice, we lean into it. Or you feel like you're reacting and pushing away a bad smell, for instance. Or leaning away from it or pushing away. And from that comes a whole set of judgments, and usually we can get into craving and clinging. You know, lots of very, very cemented notions, a very strong notion about how the world is. So this is this cycle, this little piece of the wheel of dependent origination. And this too runs on ignorance. Because we don't see it, we continue to operate in this way. And ignorance just has us reacting in the way we've always reacted. So what I don't want to suggest is that this all comes crumbling down if we don't have these normal responses. We don't want to become zombie-like in Buddhist practice. But rather we need to unpack or uncover or see clearly to wake up to this process. Then we have some choice. And we'll still have pleasant or unpleasant feelings. There'll still be contact before that. But then we have a choice about whether we get caught in reactive craving and clinging. So you can see how important this little sequence is in terms of meditation. Is this making sense? You know, just to let it unpack itself a little bit. It's always happening, you just got to go looking to see if it's really true that it is happening for you. So this craving, this tanha that I talked about before, I just want to mention something briefly about that. Tanha literally means thirst, as I said before. And the example I often give is of my grandfather. Maybe I gave it when I was here last time, I don't know. But it's such an apt example. My grandfather, as he got older, went through a period of his life where he wanted to drink water. Now, he'd have a glass of water, and normally a glass of water is enough for most of us, isn't it? You know, our thirst is quenched. But then he would have to have another one. And that would give rise to the desire for another one in very quick succession. And what would happen? He'd become sick. And then what would he do? Have another glass of water, because he couldn't help himself. He was actually ill, I think, now looking back. He eventually got through that. But this captures very much the sense of this thirst. It's more than just a desire or a need for a glass of water. It's about, well, that was great. If one was good, two is better, three will be fabulous. We actually condition wanting more and more and more and more and more. And that's what was happening to him. He was conditioning himself to wanting more and more and more, even though it was making him sick. This really captures that dreadful sense of tanha, of thirst, and quite a nasty thing. So some of you, maybe you made New Year's resolution, and maybe you've broken your New Year's resolutions already. Most people do. Most people in the world. Why is that? Because we're subject to tanha. And usually the tanha, the thing we're trying to break out of, we've practiced a lot. And so what's stronger in our minds? The practice of craving. The practice of thirsting after something. There's an interesting modern teacher, Gregory Kramer, who has a practice called insight dialogue, where we practice the Dharma in ways of how we talk with other people, how we interact with other people, how we relate to other people. Because all of this is about relationship. That's all it is, really. And he talks about the desire to, the craving to be seen by others. I might come back to that a little bit later, but this is a more psychological version of tanha, the desire to be seen in a certain sort of way. And we can spend a lot of time, making sure we're seen in certain sorts of way. I'll come back to that a little bit later anyway, because that's an interesting thing as well, if we have time. So I said I would talk about upadana or clinging a little bit more. This is, I think, a really fascinating and useful word, and it's worth having, using the search engine of your choice to look this one up. But what it means clinging, really holding tightly onto something, but it also has an association with fire in ancient Indian thought. So upadana, we can almost means the same as fire. It's interesting, because nibbana is often talked about, isn't it, as quenching the fire, of cooling down. And this is where that comes from this word upadana, which means fire, something as a flame. In fact, the Buddha said that all of our experience was a flame. And you may have heard this sutta before and wondered, well, what is that about? I don't really get what it's about. Well, when we know that fire is connected with clinging, what the Buddha is saying is so much of what we do is about craving and clinging. Everything is on fire. And it goes like this. Monks think all is a flame. Everything is a flame, in other words. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Contact and whatever there is that arises and depends on contact at the eye, experiences pleasure, pain, or neither pleasant nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fire of passion. And you see, he means like obsession or addiction here, intoxication with something. The fire of aversion, the three poisons, the fire of wanting to get rid of something, push it away, hatred, and so forth. And a flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death, sorrows, lamentations, pains, and distress, and despair. So all of our suffering is a flame. So interesting, the word upadana tells us something about what the Buddha means here. That as we get caught with anything, we get, sort of get stuck to it. So there's sort of a flame that springs up. And this is not a good thing for the Buddha. So the other meaning of fire in ancient Indian thought was fire or flame was seen to be agitated, you know, moving vigorously, really agitated. You know how when you're agitated, we say what anthem you've had. You know, you can't stand still. You just, if you've ever, anybody ever go to sleep and have cramp in their feet, or the ant, you know, running through the soles of their feet, or, you know, you just can't get settled, and this is agitation. Or when your mind won't settle, if you're upset, this is agitation. So fire was said to be agitated. Interesting. So what the Buddha also means beyond clinging is that all is a flame with agitation of mind, agitation of the emotions, agitation of the body. And this is why meditation counters that agitation of mind. Naturally, as we begin to meditate, things begin to settle. And some of that agitation dies away. The mind becomes a bit clearer, and we can work on ignorance, delusion, the most important, in a way, of the three poisons. So we become less agitated in mind and body. So this is central to the practice. And even if you're not meditating formally, it's something to remember, that just to check in occasionally with yourself, if you're walking around, see if the mind is agitated, whether the emotions are inflamed or the body is agitated, and just to practice breathing a bit and letting that be, so the mind can cool down, become, in Thailand they say, they talk about nirvana-ing the fire, an actual fire. The fire has been nirvana'd, it's gone out. So we can actually use this in a very practical day-to-day sense of ourselves as well. It's not just some mystical place that we can get to. So the thing about fire is it burns in dependence on its fuel. So in Australia we talk about a bush fire or a house fire or an oil fire. It depends on its fuel. So it's not just fire. We would say there's different sorts of fires in that particular respect. They're dependent on their source of fuel. And just in the same way, the fire of the mind burns dependent on its fuel. The fuel of aversion, the fuel of craving, the fuel of ignorance. This is how the fire springs up. It is the fuel that gives rise to that agitation of the mind. Fire also clings to what it's burned to in Indian thought. So it doesn't just spring up independent of one, it clings to it. So once it springs up, it really sticks to it. It really sticks to its sustenance, the thing that gives it life. And that's interesting as well, isn't it? That in a sense, if we're practicing hatred, it becomes a bit sticky for our minds, it agitates us in a certain way, and we get stuck to it. And as we're stuck to it, it happens more and more often. It's harder and harder to become unstuck. So fire burns in dependence upon and clinging to its fuel. The mind gets agitated according to the various delusions, the various greed and hatreds that we have. How are we going so far? Is this all making sense? Jump in if it's not an ask, or if I'm going too fast or saying too much, then just jump in. So what do we do about all this? Well, one thing we do is we remove the rubbish that the fire is burning on. In Australia, we say we backburn, don't we? We backburn to get rid of old fuel on the ground so we can't have a huge bushfire. We're certainly used to it in the past anyway. So it's really useful to clean the mind. You know that we often talk about meditation as being the path of purification, don't we? This is why we purify the mind, because then the fire can't spring up. Agitation can't spring up. There's nothing to get stuck to. There's nothing the fire can burn dependent upon and cling to. So what meditation is really is, in part, removing the rubbish. Letting the rubbish just dissipate, to rot away, to not keep throwing rubbish on a big pile so eventually the fire burns dependent on that rubbish again. So we're getting rid of the fuel for the fire. This is what meditation is. It's an interesting way of thinking about meditation. In a way, we're not trying to get anywhere. What we're doing is just not adding to the heap of fuel we've already got. So we stop practicing things that build up this rubbish in our mind. Then the rubbish just naturally isn't there anymore. We stop adding to it. So it's really, as I was saying before, it's really worth thinking about what is it that my mind burns dependent upon? For me, what is it that gets my mind and my passions inflamed? What really stirs me up? What are my flashpoints that start these fires? Once we've clarified that, we can actually start doing some work. And at the very least, we can begin to understand more clearly where we're at risk of bursting into flames and reacting in the way we've always reacted, and making sure we continue to react in exactly the same way. So we won't do it now, but it's worth thinking, just in your own time, contemplating, even during a meditation, okay, what is it that starts getting, you know, what are my flashpoints, things that upset? And then we know where to start, we need to start working, we need to start removing some of that rubbish. Broadly speaking, just to come back to that notion of tanha for a moment, what Gregory Cramer was saying, the mind has two responses to those flashpoints. It either wants more of what it's getting, because the flashpoint is pleasurable, and that will come back to that, or the flashpoint is unpleasant and we want to get away from it. We react with a lot of aversion usually there. So if you're wondering how to spot your flashpoint, try and notice when you're getting really caught in something, when you're feeling really tense and you're pushing it away. Your mind is burning at that point. You'll know it. You'll feel it in your body once you start paying attention. So to get back to Gregory Cramer, yeah, he was saying that a way of thinking about this, for example, with this sort of craving, is the craving to be seen by others in a certain sort of way. Now, I think he's spot on here. What's the modern obsession? Being famous. Isn't that true? Being famous for being famous. You don't have to be talented anymore, you just have to be good at being famous. And so people will blog outrageously so they can become well known. People will do all sorts of things to be famous. Now this traditionally is called bhava tanha. Tanha we know is craving or thirst, which Gregory Cramer calls being seen. And bhava is becoming. So it's the desire to be or become something, to be seen in a certain sort of way, or to see ourselves in a certain sort of way. And I think therein lies the key. We all want to be perceived in certain sorts of ways. And we can spend, as I was saying before, a lot of time figuring out how to be seen in certain sorts of ways. We can do it physically, with makeup, hair, clothing. We can do it psychologically in the way we speak. So in any way that other people can perceive us, we can put a lot of effort into that.
Isn't that really difficult though? Like, going through the world where everybody else is sort of like so focused on how you look and like you can't even get a chance to over a certain way of stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's absolutely exactly the right question, you know. Because the world does work this way. That's right, the world runs on the three poisons. That's why we're here. We're just old karma working itself out. That's why we're here, traditionally speaking. And that old karma is based on us getting involved in the three poisons. So what do we do now that we're living here? And most of us aren't ordained sangha and won't be. So how do we work with this stuff? that's sort of what you're saying, what you're asking, yeah. The key word here is tanha, craving. So it's not just being seen, it's the desire to be seen in a certain way so that it becomes, like my grandfather, almost addictive. You become intoxicated, that's the word I'm going to use later on. You become intoxicated with how we're seen, to follow through with your example. So let's say we've got to go to an interview. Clearly, we need to scrub up properly, don't we? We're competing against people. This is the way this world, this cycle, runs. However, knowing that we have to present in a certain way and getting really obsessed with the way we look and then judging ourselves based on how we're received, that is a whole other level of this game. So yes, we have to live. We need food, we need shelter, we need money. How much is another question. But I would say that most of us get way too caught in how we look, how we're perceived by others, than we actually need to be. We are caught in craving. Because our self-worth very often depends on what we think people think of us. So where we have a choice here is in noticing how stuck we are to this external view of ourselves. You know, if it constitutes who we think we are, we're getting caught in craving, we're getting caught in tanha. And you put your finger on the most important part of tanha and of delusion, and that is the delusion around this sense of self. And I'll come back to that soon. So that's where we need to be more discerning, to be less ignorant, to wake up to how far we think we're caught. And a way of spotting that, how agitated are we when we don't get what we want? When we're not perceived in the way we want to be perceived? When we don't get the job and we think it was because of the way we looked? How inflamed is the mind? That will tell us how entrapped we are in craving after being seen. So it's bhava tanha. So it's not just getting on in the world, it's being caught up with becoming. Does that answer what you're saying?
Yeah.
It's a tough one. We need to be seen in certain ways if you want to get on in the world. You know, most of you will want to get out and get working. You're competing against other people, and so, you know, you need to come to terms with that. And each of you will figure that out differently for yourself. If you weren't dressed as a renunciate monk, you probably wouldn't get the job in the bank. So you've got to, you know, figure out how to dress appropriately. Is that making sense? That sort of answer that question? Okay, and actually, I'll keep going with that question then, but just to say that the opposite is vibhava tanha, the desire not to be seen in a certain way, the desire to not become something. Why is this a problem? Because it's still desire. I don't want to be seen as a corporate person. I'm going to cut my hair and, you know, streak it and wear jeans or whatever it happens to be. We're still corporate in the image. We want to be seen in a certain way, but we don't want to be seen in that sort of way. This is vibhava tanha. And I think the Buddha was really onto something here. The mind has two basic functions, pleasure or pain, and response to pleasure or pain. And with pleasure, we want more. With pain, we get aversive, we push it away. So this is yet just another more psychological example of response to pleasure and pain, isn't it? Bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. Really useful word. Traditionally translated as this desire to become or not become, to be or not to be. That is the question. So Hamlet's question. Shakespeare was a Buddhist, obviously. You'll notice this very clearly in meditation when you're sitting quietly and you notice what your mind is doing with the present moment. Gosh, I like this mind state, this bodily sensation. How can I pump this up a bit more? This is great. Gee, I really hate the sense of boredom that's happening on retreat. I just need to do something. I need to change my meditation practice or find a different teacher. Change religion. So what we do with the present moment, in fact, the relationship we're having with the present moment is what will reveal bhava tanha and vibhava tanha. So we could actually say the whole of this wheel of dependent origination is, as I said before, all about the relationship we're having with our experience. And is our relationship based on ignorance? Is it based on craving? Or is it based on aversion? And if it's based on any of those, we know that the mind will be inflamed, agitated, and clinging to all the rubbish that's in the mind.
Yeah.
There's another traditional list that's really useful to look at here, and I'm not going to go too much into this, but just to put it out there for you again to have a look at it if you want. And it's called the Eight Worldly Winds. You may have heard of it. Has anybody heard of the Eight Worldly Winds? I'm not going to ask you to list them, that's fine.
Eight Worldly Concerns?
Eight Worldly Concerns, yeah. Same deal, that's right. So here it goes. This is the Loka Vipati Sutta, where the Buddha mentions this. And he says, monks, these eight worldly conditions spin after the world. That's interesting, spin after the world. The world causes these conditions to spin. Isn't that lovely? You know, the world spins our wheels. It spins our mind in certain sorts of ways. As the world spins, and as we want to spin, so our mind starts to turn as well. The wheel of samsara is spun by these eight worldly concerns or conditions. Most of these eight worldly conditions spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. So it's interactive again. Which eight? Gain and loss, and they're pairs here. Gain and loss. Gain and loss. Getting or losing, in other words. Gain and loss. And there are different words used in different sutras and people have translated them differently. You need to find your own words for these. Gain and loss. Status and disgrace. So these are twin pairs of either or, aren't they? Status, being seen, bhava-tanha, in a certain sort of way. Disgrace, being seen in a way we don't want to be seen. And how caught up do we get with all of that? And how much does the mind spin, as the emotions spin, as a result of this? The gain and loss, status and disgrace, censure and praise. Censure is being told off, isn't it? Censure and praise. How much do we really look for praise? How much are we craving praise? How much do we want to be liked by everybody? And how strongly do we react when somebody says something difficult about us, perhaps to us? How much do we really take that on board and, you know, like an arrow to the heart? They said something bad about me. Right, I'm going to go and destroy their career. So, gain and loss, status and disgrace, censure and praise, sometimes called blame and praise, and pleasure and pain. And these ones really motivate us as well, because we certainly want pleasure, and we can become intoxicated by or addicted to pleasure and the search for pleasure, or pain. Now, paradoxically, some people look for pain, and I was talking before psychologically about beating yourself up about being the worst person in the world, and we do that because we get something from it. So all our behaviours have a purpose. We want something from it, don't we? So to inflict pain on ourselves or have it inflicted gives us something very often. At least it ensures that we feel alive. And often we get interesting feedback. But we can very much respond to, react to pain as well. Mental pain, emotional pain, and or physical pain. And become addicted to avoiding that. Even physical pain, we can get very, very, very obsessed with walking around in cotton wool filling up dirt. So this is the eight worldly conditions or concerns, or the eight worldly winds, which I quite like because they sort of push us around, like wind that pushes the boats around us. They push our mind around. And this directly ties in with greed, hatred and delusion, because we're being pushed by those winds. Greed, hatred and delusion are in there somewhere as well. And the Buddha goes on in that sutta to say what we need to do about this. And he said, he talks about gain as one example. He says, gain arises for an uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person. He or she does not reflect. Gain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, it is stressful, and it is subject to change. He does not discern it or know it as it actually is. It's interesting, isn't it? And you can apply that to all of the eight worldly winds we just talked about. Gain has arisen, so it's functional. And sometimes gain does arise. That's okay, there is nothing wrong with gain as such. You know, we get the job, that's great, good. But how do we respond to that? What's our relationship with it? This is really the question that we're asking here. So for the uninstructed person, the person who hasn't got right view, hasn't thought about this, hasn't looked at the wheel of dependent origination and yama and so forth, they don't reflect in a certain way. How don't they reflect? They don't see it as inconstant. They don't see it as stressful and subject to change. Inconstant means it comes and goes. It comes and goes. Look at people who have been famous and they stop being famous. They suffer enormously because very often their self-worth is tied up with their with fame. And you come to sort of believe you are a person. Rock stars are a classic example here. They come to believe they are somebody special. Not when they're famous. Are you special when you're not famous anymore? Or not if you've identified as the same? Who's looking at you now? Nobody. Well, you must be not real. Less than you were before. Stressful. This is dukkha, the meaning here. Dukkha, suffering. Unpleasant. It causes us to be stuck. It causes the mind to become inflamed. So it leads to suffering. But we don't see that. We actually go, wow, bring it on. It's great. I'm getting famous now. And we really revel in the whole thing. And it gets stuck to us. And if it's stuck to us, the mind starts to burn dependent on that particular fuel that we've got. Subject to change means that all of our experience is conditional. Every single aspect of what we experience is a whole set of conditions coming together and dropping away. Now, some come together and drop away very quickly, in a microsecond, countless things each microsecond, but some things are much more constant, the body, for example. But even the body changes. It's less obvious, but we can see it change over time. I used not to have grey hair, what a surprise. And now it's changed. If I'd been addicted or intoxicated with my flowing locks, I'd be suffering enormously. Unfortunately, I'm not really, which is just lucky, it's not my addiction of choice. But I'd be suffering enormously. I'd be dyeing my hair or wearing a wig. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? But yeah, as you can see, I'm not. But the Buddha actually said, if you're going to identify with anything, you're better off to identify with your body because it changes a bit more slowly. But as soon as you start investigating the mind, you will notice how quickly it changes. The mind moves so much faster than that each moment. And meditation reveals that. So to identify with that, you're just getting a hold of it and it's gone. Getting a hold of it and it's gone. Getting a hold of it and it's gone. Have a pleasant mind state, it's gone. And then you regret the fact that it's gone. You want it back. This is one of the three forms of dukkha, the suffering, that you can't hang on to what you've got, or you get something like grey hair and you can't get rid of it. Mm. The Buddha spoke very specifically about that, that's suffering as well, if you're identified with it not being that way. Probably because I don't see the grey hair, I like it. Yeah. One less thing to identify with. To answer that question, it's very amusing, I like it, but also it's a sign of renunciation and going to, it's a traditional sign of being homeless, actually. And you may have seen, for those who perhaps haven't seen this, there's traditional statues or pictures of the Buddha when he was Shakyamuni holding up his long hair with the sword and cutting through the hair, the symbol of renouncing the home, being at home in the home life, going forth. But it may well be useful for us to shave the head that way as well. But you can get really caught up with having a really nice bald head as well. In Burma, they're obsessed with a really shiny head. In Thailand, they're obsessed with not having hair in their ears. So, it's different for each culture, really. I'm not sure about other parts of Asia or Southeast Asia, but each culture has its particular obsessions. But in Burma, they shave their head quite a lot. In Tibet, they don't. You've probably seen Tibetan monks, and they'll let their hair, or nuns, they'll let their hair grow quite a bit. Maybe because it's colder, I don't know. But in Burma, they like a nice shiny head. So not contemplating that things are in constant stress or subject to change is true of all of the eight worldly winds, the eight worldly concerns. So this is not a good thing to do, to just to take them as they are and get caught up in clearly the Buddha is saying. And the Buddha says we get consumed with these things, we welcome them. For example, he says his mind remained consumed with gain. His mind remained consumed with loss, status, disgrace, censure, pleasure, and so forth. And we get consumed with pain as well. So we get consumed. And this is a great... Consumed is a word we use with fire as well, isn't it? Fire consumes things. It eats them. It grows strong on them. So we get consumed by that thing that we haven't looked at correctly, that we're not correctly perceiving, that we're ignorant of. It says, the uninstructed person welcomes the arisen gain and rebels against the arisen loss. We get really caught in, you know, wanting more of the good and really pushing against the bad. We welcome the arising of status and rebel against disgrace, and so forth and so on. So, the Buddha says, if you do this, you are not released from suffering. He makes it very clear. So this is really important. So we're right, if we don't see clearly, what we're doing is cultivating the tree. They're growing in us. We're practicing, as it were, practicing the three poisons in all of this. So he goes on, now gain arises for a well-instructed disciple of the Noble One. He reflects in this way, gain has arisen for me. But notice here, the Buddha is saying very clearly that even for monks and nuns, these things can arise as well. Gain and respect and pain and pleasure and so forth. So monks and nuns aren't zombies. You may have noticed that already. But some of the people look at Buddhism and go, what's the point? You just become a zombie. But no, the Buddha is very clearly saying we experience all these things. But what's our relationship with those things? And he goes on to say, the well-instructed person reflects, gain has arisen for me. So it's functional. This is how things are. So we're not pretending. We're not sugarcoating. We're saying, this is really what's going on. But what is its nature? It is inconstant. You can't get a hold of it. It's stressful, it's suffering, it's dukkha, and it's subject to conditionality. It is conditionality, it's subject to change. He discerns it as it actually is, and again, that's with all of the outworldly concerns. So he does not welcome the arisen gain. He does not welcome the arisen gain. Now, I need to really stress something here. The Buddha doesn't say you should reject the arisen gain. This comes back to your idea of going for a job or something. Oh, well, we'd love to offer you a job. No, no, I can't do it because it's a game. You wouldn't reject it. nor do monks or nuns. It just is as it is. It's functional. So he goes to say, he does not welcome or reject the arisen game or rebel against the arisen loss. He does not welcome or rebel against any of them. As he thus abandons welcoming and rebelling, he is released from birth, aging, and death, from sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despair. That's just a formula I use to do the suffering, all of those things, physical and mental and emotional suffering. That's the formula that's used in the sutras. He is released, I tell you, from suffering and stress. Another way of putting that is the flame has nothing more to burn on. There's no fuel. Because we've seen clearly, we've dispelled ignorance, we're not getting caught in craving, we're not getting caught in aversion, and so there's nothing for the flame to erupt, to cling to burn dependent upon. Our mind is not agitated. This is the other formula that's often used. As you go through a sequence towards enlightenment, you become disenchanted. That is, an enchantment here is like a spell, so you see through the spell. The mind is calm and not agitated and not clinging. The mind is released. So a prerequisite for awakening and liberation is just not clinging. And not clinging depends on going back through those couple of factors in the wheel of dependent origination that I've talked about before. So we see that there has been becoming. You know, we've grown into something, we track back and we see, oh, this is the way it happened. I grasped onto something. That came from craving. That came from contact and feeling in contact. And so we undo this cycle of dependent origination. It actually can't spin in the same sort of way. It can't spin in relation to craving and clinging. And the flame dies away. But the flame needs that. The flame is craving and clinging and aversion. Craving to get rid of, which is aversion. So clarity of vision, seeing clearly, leads to the mind being released. The mind that's not agitated and not clinging, the mind that here and now is released. So nirvana has two meanings, really. One is this notion of the unconditioned, But the other one is the notion here and now of nirvana, the fire going out here and now, the mind being cooled down. And being cool here, we know now, means not agitated. When nirvana-ing, it's a verb really, here and now. And that's a possibility for everybody to some extent. It might be the absolute unconditioned, but it is a mind that's quiet, cool, free, and very open, very vast. And it's a very friendly mind as well. It's a mind that is not filled with clinging craving. So this is how the three poisons play out for us personally. I just wanted to say something briefly about how they play out institutionally as well. Because Buddhism is very much a social path as well. It's not just this selfish path for oneself. The Buddha was constantly talking about the need for good companions, friends. He talked about society and how to work with society, how to work with mothers and fathers and kids, and you know, he talked with princes and kings as well. So it's a social path. It's not, you know, this is why we're all here together. It's not just me and one other person, or me just by myself. Thank goodness. So institutionally, I guess my take, and then you may agree or disagree with this, is that we can see greed, hatred and delusion playing out in a broader society. Professionally, I think, with corporations, we can see that clearly corporations are about profit. This is how the world works. But, you know, sometimes I think vast amounts of profit made for the shareholders, sometimes at the expense, often at the expense of other groups of people. Sometimes at great expense, as we know, when people are working in poverty, producing luxury goods for us. And corporations can just say, well, that's what we're on about. This is what we do. You know, and not make any real choices about where they want to invest their money or how they want to work. There's a great Buddhist writer called David Lloyd, and he actually says this reduces us to the level of an animal. Animals react, so they don't really make choices very much. If their choices, they're quite limited. And we know pigs are quite smart, so they can probably make better choices. Mm-hmm. But when we refuse to investigate and make good quality choices institutionally as part of an organisation, then we are somewhat like an animal. We are already part of the animal realm, one of those six realms that I was talking about on your wheel of skin and origination. Now, there can be a benefit then because we're ignorant. One of the three poisons. And we sometimes say ignorance is bliss. Well, it certainly allows us to do sometimes very nasty things and disclaim any responsibility, even at a corporate level. And really just saying this is how things are is just an argument for selfishness and greed, because I want to be part of it. Give me, think of my snout in the trough, because I want some of that for myself. Also, what we're not seeing here is that we're connected with other people. This is a social world, it's a world of relationships. We are always in relationship, either with ourselves or with other people. There is no escape from it. And yet when we don't look at how this plays out at a larger level in the world, what we're really practicing is selfishness and greed, and saying the world out there doesn't mean anything to me. I don't have responsibility. And really, then we're not practicing generosity, loving kindness, and developing wisdom. We're actually working right in the field of the three poisons. Militarism, the growth of the military around the world, I think would be another really good example of greed, hatred, and delusion, and how it plays itself out. Especially when you start hearing stories about the good guys and the bad guys, how easy that is. You know, clearly we're all the good guys, obviously we are, unless somebody says we're the bad guys, and how we react against that, and the mind becomes inflamed. You know, you can think of quite recent wars where the other side has been characterised as the bad guys, and it just makes it a bit easier for us to do what we have to do, because they're clearly the bad guys. Forget that there are families, children, that are bombed and so forth, landmines that are laid with millions of people, clearly we're just dealing with the bad guys. So this is just an application of responsibility again. And I think the other way that, the other group that we can clearly see closer to home maybe, that dabbles with greed, hatred and delusion is the advertising industry, the media generally. Large media often is aligned with a particular political party, it's just the way it is. And advertising exists to make us anxious, to have the mind agitated. That's what sells things. Look at why you buy things, why you want a particular brand and not another, because you think you're going to get something from it. And usually it's a way of looking, a way of being. We have a certain feeling about ourselves and who we are. And if I don't get that, then you know, I'll fall behind. I won't get the job. I won't be respected. I'll let myself down. It's worth, you've probably all done this anyway, but really thinking about advertising in this sort of way. See if it provokes anxiety. See if it wants your mind to be agitated. Look how often, you know, advertising works with the ideas of the best as opposed to not the best. And clearly we want the best. So it works on making the mind agitated. So, you know, and the classic argument from the advertising industry is, well, we just advertise it, this is the smoking industry, the tobacco industry as well, people will choose whether they want it or not. And in part that's true, but actually the advertising industry is incredibly skillful at encouraging us to make the choices they want us to make. Incredibly skillful. You know, it's a whole, it really is quite a science. So amazing to read about it. So, and it's a science dedicated to making us agitated so that they get what they want, which is for us to purchase the product they're pushing. Really irrelevant what the product is. Who cares if it's bad for you? You know, we can dismiss that by saying, well, you'll make a choice. Well, no, but that's really true, quite frankly. You know, let's flood the streets with cocaine or ice. People will make a choice. You know, it's the sort of point it gets down to. Where do you draw the line on that one? So I think we can say that greed, hatred and delusion do play out institutionally. This is what turns the world from a Buddhist perspective. I don't even doubt about that. It's just a matter of not just mouthing the words, but thinking clearly, where does it play out? How does it play out? And what is my role in that? So sometimes this path is a bit of a difficult path, actually, because it does challenge us as to how far we want to play the game, how ethical we do want to be. It's clearly a challenge for us. How much we're going to get caught in craving and aversion. And sometimes we try and avoid this by just being amoral, that is, not making moral choices at all. Well, that's a real choice. It's a choice not to be involved, to let other people suffer regardless of us, you know, just so that we don't have to bear their suffering. So, just the last thing, maybe on advertising, to bring us back to the wheel of the centre of the wheel of dependent origination. And I mentioned earlier that delusion is built around one central delusion. This whole mass of suffering is built around one central delusion. And that is that there is a me that exists independent of other people and that needs to be nurtured and can be made safe and is permanent and is mine. Now, all of us have that feeling because none of us are fully enlightened. Even people who have awakening experiences still have a feeling of this type of sense of self. And Buddhism clearly is not saying we don't exist. Clearly we exist, we do. But if we start looking for this person who is independently existing in here, separate from others, and who can treat others badly, independent of them, we actually can't find that person. But advertising seeks to provoke anxiety so that we'll make this self, this particular sense of self, safe, recognised, loved, so that we'll get what we want from this self. And so often we'll hear people say, if I just got X, then I'd be okay, then I'd get what I want, then people would look at me differently, then my parents would love me, then I'd get the correct marks, then I'd get the job, then I'd be a rock star, then I'd be whatever. And so it goes on. And the more we practice that agitated, anxious mind state, guess what? The better we get at it. So we need to see clearly how this whole thing spins, so that we can, like the Buddha, step out of that wheel of samsara, step out of being caught in craving, delusion, and aversion. So really finally, I guess what I'm saying, and I hope I'm echoing the Buddha here, is saying that we need to practice this path. And the path is the Eightfold Path. Everything I've been talking about tonight is in the Eightfold Path. There's understanding, theoretical and experiential. There's our way of living for ourselves and our interaction with the world, which I've just been talking about. And then the path of practice or meditation. And so all of this exists already in the Eightfold Path. But unless we walk the path, then we don't get the benefit. And in a way we can say, well, that a path has an end, and that's full awakening. We can also say this is an awakening path, that as we walk it and do it, so we become more and more awake. We become nirvanaed as we go along to deeper and deeper levels. So it's the path of awakening, or the awakening path. So we need to walk it. And so this sort of understanding we've been getting tonight, I think, is really central to then understanding that path and how the whole thing spins, really. And I really like this, this visual representation. It's just yet another way of reminding ourselves. And it can be quite useful to find a really nice version of this and stick it up on your wall or something. I mean, where am I today? Which realm am I in? Check where the mind's at. So I think we've got time for a bit of chat if you want to. And hello. very good timing. bit of conversation if you like, or questions, or you know, you can bring up other points if you want to as well. So, ask away.
Yeah. In the middle of the wheel of samsara, the pig is playing the snake and the...
Oh, thank you. Yes, you know, thank you for that. There are different versions of this, of course. What I take that to mean is that all these three things are joined in together. Out of ignorance, out of delusion, what comes out of delusion? One of two movements of mind, aversion or craving. So it's natural that they're joined by the pig biting them here, because it's delusion that bites us all the time, that gets us trapped and not seeing clearly. And we take craving to be pleasurable, for example, and like my grandfather, again, with that drinking the water, he clearly there was some pleasure in the immediate act of drinking, but in fact it was making him sick. So it's a very powerful example of that particular, that very particular point, that he was deluded in a very sad sort of way, and thank goodness got through it, but suffered accordingly, because of what he thought was pleasurable at what was actually painful. Yeah. So thanks for reminding me about that. Yeah, what's what.
Yeah. You were talking about...
what was I talking about?
Something to do with... oh yeah, that's right. Trying to have an image of something. Like, you try and... Like, I want the world to look at me and something like that.
Yes, yes. Bawa Tanha. Yeah, grasping after being seen in a certain sort of way.
Does that go all the way down to... I'm a guy, I have to be seen as masculine, I'm a woman, I have to be seen as feminine?
Yeah, again, it's really the same answer I gave you before. It depends how much you're caught up with that. You know, if you're really, really caught up with that and really enmeshed in ideas of what it means to be a male, for example, or female, then yes, that would be Vibhava Tanha. Now, two examples there. For men, for example, what's happened is this whole sort of plastic body business of doing bodybuilding and shaving all your hair off, right? So Ajahn Sumedho used to say, if you want a perfect body, get a plastic body. And people do, they get inserts to have bigger calf muscles and all sorts of things. Yeah, really. So that would be an extreme, I would, from Buddha's perspective. And why is that? I think underneath that, and I'm hoping no bodybuilders in the group here, because I'm going to get attacked, I suspect there's a degree of insecurity about how you perceive. You're bought into a sort of idea of how you should look very strongly. I would say there's an agitation of mind there. Flip side, that would be, for women maybe, would be more typically plastic surgery, although more increasingly for men as well. You know, it's very hard to resist this stuff. And you see people who, maybe you're in Hollywood or in that sort of business, an incredible push to look a certain sort of way. And it is, there's an allure to it. Who wants to be seen as being ugly? Nobody. Because you get rejected, you get put down, you don't get what you want. People who are good looking do tend to get the jobs. It's true. Good-looking babies get a lot more attention than ugly babies. Sorry to say it, but it happens. You watch it. Good-looking cats and dogs, they get a lot of pets. Ugly cats and dogs, they don't get a lot of pets. Oh, there's no such thing as ugly cats and dogs. Okay, well, yeah. I think those little hairless, skinny things for me are good ugly. But actually, it is a matter of how each person perceives that that's right. The wrinkly ones, the hair, you know. The ones with too much skin. What's that? Do you mean beauty? It may well be. We seem to, human beings go for regular and uniform features, and I think we've just taken that. And because we have a lot of leisure, we have a lot of time and money to get caught up with this stuff. If you're busy working every day and you're just struggling to make a living, this stuff, you know, just goes by the board. But we can get obsessed by ourselves. We've got more time to look in the mirror, haven't we? And to get feedback about how we look. So, you know, teeth getting done, eyes getting done, waxing, plastic surgery, the whole thing. And people can look like freakish, can't they? Still, what's to our eyes, I guess, could still think they look fabulous because they're in that culture that feeds back to them that doing this stuff to your body makes you look better. In a way, who cares? In a way, it doesn't matter because, you know, you are what you are functionally and you do what you do. The really important bit is, what is it doing to our mind and our emotions? Is it leading to more suffering from the Buddha's perspective for us, or is it leading to a cooling of the mind? Letting go or being free of an openness and a spaciousness where we just let people more or less be who they are and we're reasonably comfortable with who we are. Now, it doesn't mean we can't work on ourselves, because clearly we have this notion of good desire, desire that's useful, that leads away from suffering. But to be entrapped in particular views about how we should look and really to beat ourselves up for not looking that way, and then to have to compete with an aging body, always going to break down. We're caught. And I often wonder about people who are 40 or 50 or 60 who have really worked hard to be beautiful, have always been seen as beautiful, and that starts to dissipate. I think it's an incredible difficulty for them. And you have to struggle even harder. So cougars are amazing, aren't they? You know, where it's women who are in their 40s wanting to look like they're in their 20s and have boyfriends who are, you know, significantly younger. It's amusing in a way, you know, whatever, it's just another sort of delusion or an aversion or craving or whatever. But, you know, people can do what they want. It's not up to us to judge that. But it's sort of sad from in the perspective of the mind is inflamed here. We're absolutely caught with how I should look. Well, guess what? You know, what you try to hang on to is going to cause suffering, because it is of the nature to dissipate and decay. It is conditioned. This is the third sort of dukkha. And the self that we try to harvest so strongly, spend so much time on the psychological, emotional self, let alone the physical, is also subject to conditionality and decay. And it doesn't exist to start with in the way we think it does. So we're deluded right from the start. So when we get caught with all these notions of who we are and how we're presenting ourselves, we're actually fundamentally misperceiving what this thing is, this mind and body. And that's the danger there, that's the pain of it. That's a long answer to a short question anyway. There's another question here, we come back there, yeah. I think that's somewhat different again, and there are lots of reasons for gender reassignment, so it's a huge issue, and I certainly have friends who are going through gender reassignment as well, so I wouldn't want to have a go at people in that respect. But what can we say about that? If people are heavily identified as being a particular sex, then, and feel that the way they look isn't in line with that, then of course they have the option now of feeling more comfortable about themselves. I think that's less of a worry than people who are just doing cosmetic surgery and corporate image and stuff. Mm-hmm. And often people will say right from early on they always thought they'll be other sex. Or no sex at all, but then that case in the papers just recently, that an intersex guy. Yeah. So less of a worry, but still, yeah, there's an identification with being a certain sort of way. We've got to be careful that we're not getting to blame, you know, putting people down. It's really just our own aversion or all the praise and delusion. There was a question here.
From the picture, as you said, it's delusion that connecting hatred and greed.
Yes.
So that means wisdom is the most important character.
Definitely, yeah. Wisdom is the most important thing for us to have. Seeing clearly, waking up, because then we can do something about what. Even intellectually, like having this talk and reflecting on this, that's part of gaining wisdom, because we can start to see what's going on, and then we can practice more skillfully to be free from suffering, to be free from craving or aversion. So definitely, wisdom, absolutely. This is the path of insight. It's the path. It's a wisdom practice, for sure.
That's how we practice.
Definitely. See where you're caught, and once you see where you're caught and what it means to be caught, then you can take steps. But if you don't see or know, if you don't have wisdom even to start with, even a little bit of wisdom, there's nowhere to go. You're just going to keep doing what you've always done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
and get more of the core. Yeah. And there was another one here, maybe?
Oh, well, how about craving for, like, you know, self-respect, like, your boyfriend's turning you on.
Yeah.
Like, I crave.
Again, as soon as we use the word craving, there's an issue from a perspective. But feeling that one is, at the very least, equal to others, not better or not worse, is absolutely fine. You know, because this is about not getting caught up with either being worse and beating ourselves up, or being seen wanting to be better than and pushing others away or putting them down. So it's a big problem in the West that people either are trying to elevate themselves above others, or have real dreadful, you know, self-esteem, dreadful feelings about themselves. But a healthy self-respect is useful. I'm sure the Buddha had a healthy self-respect, except he also knew the self was not what we would all take it to be, permanent, abiding, unchanging, a mean centrally on the inside. So confidence in knowing oneself very clearly who one is absolutely, it should arise from the past. And we get less stressed about people who don't see us that way anyway. It's not quite, bit by bit, it's not quite so important. It doesn't hurt so much. And we get less entrapped by people, you know, having to have people like us all the time. So the craving begins to settle down, the fire, those particular fires start. But it's worth asking, do I feel myself more or less roughly the same as others? And if not in either direction, then that we would want to address the other. Because that's self blame or self praise. We're back with the idea that we can take work. This is interesting once you start thinking about it. Really, it's quite practical in a way. And it should be practical, really, that's how. Yeah. My grandfather, yeah. Do you know, I'm sad I can't answer the question of how he actually overcame that. I was a lot younger, this was quite a few years ago. And he did get through it, but I don't really know how. What I think was happening, I think it was a sort of obsessive compulsive disorder now, looking back. And I think probably his circumstances changed, and so whatever was provoking that, it settled down again. And so much of this is provoked by external circumstances. You know, we don't really see clearly what's going on. And it's not until certain conditions change that we start to notice. So we're feeling okay, we think we don't need to practice. And maybe that's true while we're feeling okay, but you know, sooner or later conditions are going to change and we're not going to feel so good. So there's a need for practicing even when we're basically feeling okay. So I think probably conditions change for him, and whatever the irritant was, it was causing him to suffer so badly, as I now see it, after all, as all things do. Maybe make us lucky last.
How do you feel about the use of psychedelic drugs in combination with meditation?
It's an old hippie question. What a great question. This used to come up quite a lot and hasn't come up for a while, so thank you for asking it. Look, I'm not a drug user, and I haven't really been a drug user, so I can't speak from my own experience, and I apologise for that. But I've certainly known plenty of people, and friends who have certainly used quite a lot of psychedelics and stuff. What they will say about it is that the mind can experience, you know, really quite incredible states of openness, but in a way it just passes. There's no wisdom factor that maintains it. So it might give an indication of what's possible, but often it's a very confused state of mind anyway, if you're lucky enough to have a deeper experience. And certainly cultures throughout the centuries and millennia have used psychedelics, like shamans, for example, witch doctors, whatever, have used psychedelics to open themselves up to deeper levels of experience, other ways of knowing. From a Buddhist perspective, you know, we don't have a sort of moral stance, but if it leads away from wisdom, they're not useful. If it leads to addiction or intoxication, then that's just another fire that's burning and not useful. And ultimately, whilst it might open a door, Aldous Huxley called it the doors of perception. From a Buddhist perspective, because it's not a wisdom factor, we can't see the process clearly, then it can't last. It can't have a depth, perhaps I should say. Whereas in meditation practice, we do come to see more and more clearly how the process works, and it's like a gradual disentangling ourselves from this whole mess. A and this is the wisdom factor we're talking about here. So I don't think Buddhists have a particular moral position, except they're intoxicants that confuse the mind, so it's just, they're not useful. But you know, it's not as they do or don't go to heaven depending on whether you're intoxicants. We don't have that particular view. But if you're continually confusing the mind, and confusing the mind doesn't have to be intoxicants like psychedelics. It can be excessive use of computer games. It can be watching a whole heap of tally. It can be taking drugs. Anything that dulls the mind, really. Yes, food. Yeah, sure, absolutely. Anything where we get caught up with craving, thinking about, imagining, we can dull the mind excessively. But intoxicants, there's a whole lot of stuff. It's not just, you know, things like psychedelics. Thank you for that very old-fashioned question. I appreciated that, and so you don't hear it very often these days. But I think it's a very good question to ask, actually. Yeah. Otherwise, we'd all just take a pill and become enlightened. So just to say, in a way, meditation practice is not about any particular experience. Because experience is past. Wisdom is not an experience as such. It's a deep letting go. It's non-cravingness, non-clinging. It's not some fabulous psychedelic experience. Because that's just an experience, and it doesn't carry any weight with us in an ongoing sort of way. Non-clinging, non-grasping, non-craving, non-delusion. That is wisdom. That's why I think the Buddha often used these negatives. Rather than talking in positive terms, it's this or that, he would say it's not this, it's not that, it's not that. Because when those things aren't there, what's left is a mind that's calm and clear and open. That's probably a nice place to finish, really. So look, I really wish you well with all of that and hope it's been useful. As I was saying, I think it's useful to reflect on, and you know, I think it's really practical as well. So I wish you well with all of that, and I'll see you at the next talk. Thank you.